This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be joined by the famous whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers story to the New York Times in the 60s.
He's smart, he's courageous, and he thinks that the coup in this country has already happened.
We'll talk with author Brian Palmer about his new book, James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left.
Cannon headed up the International Labor Defense, the predecessor organization to the National Lawyers Guild, which we're all in. So this is our grandfather.
We'll also hear from a protest in front of the Pakistani mission in New York, condemning the state of emergency and attacks on lawyers and the judiciary there. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. We at Law and Disorder are very proud to have Daniel Ellsberg on as our special guest. Ellsberg was one of the people who was most influential in ending the war by the United States against the Vietnamese people when he released the Pentagon Papers showing the lies of the American government some 40 years ago. He hasn't stopped blowing the whistle. He gave an excellent speech last month on the dangers of a coup in America, which in part he thinks has already happened. We want to ask him why he thinks so and what we can do about it. Daniel Ellsberg, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Daniel, you've been a hero of mine for your courage and your intelligence ever since the 1960s when I, like you, was active against the war in Vietnam. And when I read a copy of the speech that you gave in D.C. where you said you woke up one morning and it dawned on you that the coup has already taken place and that the second step in the coup to implement all these police state laws that they've put into place might very well happen if they attack Iran or if there's another terrorist attack in this country. And you explicated that to the audience. I thought, this is something that we really have to get out on Law and Disorder. So I wanted to ask you, what do you mean when you say the coup has already taken place?
Well, let's put it this way. Just this week, we've just seen the classic military coup, military takeover in Pakistan, which is being confronted there right now, with massive detentions of civil liberties people and activists of various kinds.
Including lawyers.
Yes, a coup of lawyer against lawyers. And a question is this the first coup in Pakistan? Obviously, there was the coup when Musharraf first took over as a military man some years ago.
Yeah.
But since then, he's been lauded as moving toward democracy by President Bush, who gives that as an excuse for the $10 billion in aid we've given him in recent years, along with his alleged help against the Taliban, which has not resulted in depriving Osama bin Laden of a base in his own country, apparently, in Pakistan. But in any case, supposedly we had a country moving toward democracy. Was it really all that different from what we have now? It was covert. But this military martial law is obviously hardly a total break from the kind of regime we've had before. I noticed that Benazir Bhutto identifies it in the New York Times as a military dictatorship. Well, was it something different from that in previous years? The analogy I'm making here is I believe that another coup in this country, the U.S., may well lie in our future, even our fairly close future within the next year, and that would look a lot more like Pakistan today with massive detention camps and massive arrests, a pretty open dictatorship. But what you're referring to in my other speech was the realization I had the other day that there has been a coup already, a quieter one, sort of a rolling coup. It doesn't have this characteristic of a military takeover by a military man, but rather the transformation of a civilian-run constitutional democracy within a number of years, but not that many, not more than 6 or 7, and really one can see roots of that even earlier in the preceding administration in the way of surveillance and other matters, and that the basis, the infrastructure for a full police state has been built during this period. NSA has been let loose illegally and unconstitutionally on American citizens for 6 years now, though we didn't know it at the time. And the detentions, the rendition, the torture, the unconstitutional, or I should say the manipulation of Congress unconstitutionally into a war, like what happened in Vietnam when I was in the Pentagon, all of these things are not just subversive of democracy, they contradict democratic rule and constitutional rule. And to say that is to say we have been living in, to say the least, an outlaw state for about 6 years. And to call it an outlaw state is to acknowledge, is to claim that there are effective laws, which is actually in question the more you look at it at this point. The Senate Judiciary Committee confirmed the Attorney General, who has openly said in his open testimony that, like his predecessor, Gonzalez, and the other lawyers, like David Addington, he believes the president can set aside laws when he regards it as necessary for national security. We have a situation where the president has been acting like a dictator for some years in the belief that he is entitled to do that, that he's told by lawyers, a little cabal of lawyers like David Addington, Jay Bybee, in particular, John Yoo, YOO, now of Bolt Hall, Tim Flanagan, a handful of lawyers, in other words, who have views shared by almost no lawyer outside the administration, I'm told, that the Constitution itself meant originally to prolong the war powers of King George III. This is what John Yoo says in so many words, which is absurd as far as I know. I'm a layman, but I read people like David Cole and others, and Marjorie Cohn and others. And my own reading of the constitutional debates, which goes back to the war powers question back in Iran and Vietnam 30 years ago, I did interest myself in that part of the law. And even I, with my shallow knowledge of this subject, know that the legal doctrine that they've been announcing, that the original motives were to not to change the power of the kings, King George III and his predecessors, to decide when to go to war, is a reverse, simply, of what people like Madison and others.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, I've litigated a lot of these cases with both Cole and Lobel on war powers, and of course, the U position is completely wrong. But I was interested in your term. You used the term rolling coup, and I think that's a really important point, and talking about it as a non-military so far. But I think in your talk that we've read, you talk about events that could trigger really more of even a military coup or...
I go back to what I'm saying. First of all, it would not be a military coup. It would maintain the civilians, not just military men in civilian clothes, but highly militarized civilians of the kind that have run the civilian part of the country, national security apparatus, since the beginning of the Cold War. I was one of those, I would say. Served them, at any rate. They're civilians in name and in background, but militarists, essentially. However, they're not under military discipline. They are under party discipline and an internal oath of fealty or loyalty to a single leader, the president, to whom they relate as to a Führer, in so many words. You know, it's been dangerous all my adult life in discussion to make any analogies to what happened in Germany in the 30s, because that's regarded as extremist, as fanatic, so forth, demagogic, and putting you outside the pale of serious discourse. I would prefer not to make such an analogy, except for the fact that if we're trying to learn from the past and discover some analogies to what's been going on here for the last 6 years, and may proceed even further, there aren't too many cases of an elected civilian government in a constitutional democracy, deliberately transforming, in the case of Germany, legally by emergency provisions in their constitution, which we don't have, transforming it into a dictatorship. I'd be interested to hear from you or anybody other precedents we could look to. I think the Indira Gandhi's emergency is one worth looking at, and perhaps Marcos in the Philippines. But mostly you have military coups, which is a different matter.
Well, Daniel, what do you think has happened since 9/11 here in the United States, which has paved the way for a dictatorship? What laws and practices and procedures have they invoked, just like Hitler had his emergency decrees and so on? What have they done here to take it away from a democracy and more towards a military coup?
Right. We have a president and a vice president and their subordinate who have acknowledged now what they had done secretly for a matter of years. And that is, in two respects, violate clear-cut, explicit laws, both domestic laws, international treaties, the UN Charter, the UN Convention Against Torture in that case, and the Constitution. Specifically, in the area of torture, we see discussions nowadays of whether torture is necessary and whether it's effective and what is really torture, ignoring the simple point that, rightly or wrongly, torture is illegal and has been clearly illegal in this country for more than a decade. In particular, it's been a trend for a long time. It could be held to have been illegal even earlier. But in the 90s, laws were passed making it clear-cut illegality, and yet the president and the vice president continue to defend actions that are widely, universally recognized as torture. So they've been breaking the law all this time. Now, to justify that in a genuine emergency situation, a matter of days or even weeks after 9/11, would probably not give rise to huge challenge in the country, certainly. But we've had this going on now for 6 years.
What do you think of the law that allows the president to use the National Guard from one state in another state without permission from either governor, or the detention camp that was set up?
Okay, that is one of the points I referred to as building the legal infrastructure for the allegedly legal infrastructure for martial law. It wouldn't be fair to call it military dictatorship because, again, it will be not only nominally under the control of probably the Homeland Security Department now, used to be FEMA, and the president and the vice president. But under him, martial law, coordinating the various National Guard units, police, militia of various kinds, and the regular army. This law that you refer to is just almost a year old now, in December, I think it was, of last year. And Senator Leahy pointed out that it amounted to a revocation of the 1878 law, the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the use of military and police actions in this country. This makes it just that much easier. Well, they're really ignoring Posse Comitatus.
Let me remind our listeners, we've been speaking with one of our heroes, Daniel Ellsberg. He's as lucid now as he was 35 years ago. What kind of scenario would you paint, say, if they do launch a war against Iran, or if there's some kind of terrorist attack here, or if there's some kind of natural disaster? What steps would they take against us?
Steps would be taken very quickly, which have all been prepared, and a number of which they have secured for reasons we could talk about. I can only speculate about. They secured from Congress, to a large extent. The question of calling up the National Guard, which you just referred to, was, after all, voted by Congress. And whether it's and deceptive, hardly without any debate, I believe. Right? Now, moreover, in August, the Congress purported, under threat of being called terrible names, especially if there was another 9/11, purported to legalize the NSA surveillance, which has been going on illegally and unconstitutionally for 6 years. I say purported because there is the Fourth Amendment that hasn't actually been repealed yet, and whether Congress can constitutionally do it. There was the what I've called the legal infrastructure, or allegedly legal infrastructure, for a police state. Now, if there is, let's take this strong case, if there is another 9/11, or you mentioned a government attack on Iran, which in itself, the initial U.S. attack or Israeli attack, might not lead immediately to the institution of these police measures. It probably wouldn't evoke the kind of emergency feeling in this country that would call for that. But Iran is virtually certain to respond to that, to retaliate in various ways, including heavy violence against U.S. forces in Iran there, and possibly also direct attacks on our shipping in the Persian Gulf and elsewhere, possibly a terrorist attack. In the case, Iranian retaliation to our attack, which I think will be the excuse for an all-out U.S. attack on Iran, probably involving figure 2,500 targets has been mentioned. In another case, study 4,000 targets. But an all-out demolition of Iran, basically, which again will lead presumably to further Iranian retaliation, possibly against Israel, by the way, which I didn't mention earlier. In the case, then, where Iran will be easily presented by the president as a danger to the United States, killing Americans now, which they're already claiming without any evidence, but after our attack, Americans will die from Shia, if not by the direct instigation of Iran. There will just be a uprising in Iraq. So we'll be at war with Iran. I think the political effects here will be like that of another 9/11. And in either case, then, we'll see massive detention, hundreds of thousands of Middle Easterners, and the kind of people who are being detained right now in Pakistan, troublemakers of a nature like you and me, and people who talk about constitutions and civil liberties and civil rights and so forth, will accompany the Middle Easterners into camps like those that held the concentration camps that held the Japanese in World War II. That was 120,000. And I'm talking now 400,000 or 500,000. The contract for building such camps was let to KBR, a subsidiary of Halliburton, a couple of years ago. And presumably they have been built or being built right now. Second, total surveillance of the American population. If there's anything the NSA isn't yet doing in the way of recording all
formulation.
Our electronic transactions, credit card, banking transactions, email, fax, phone, for later retrieval when necessary. If there's anything left to do, it will get started. If the total information awareness program that Admiral Poindexter was supposedly in charge of before, if that isn't actually in covert operation right now, which means enlisting thousands, well, hundreds of thousands of, I understand they're working on bus drivers, school bus drivers right now, but meter readers, postmen, anybody who gets near your house to observe anything suspicious, even better yet, people who get inside your house for whatever reason, they will be reporting. And one reason they will be cooperating is that every detail of their private lives will be known to the government through the NSA programs. Third, I think, well, I feel very sure, there will be a draft. People, of course, rule that out now because it would be so politically unpopular now, and that's true. But after 9/11 or war with Iran, I believe very strongly there will be a draft. They feel they need it right now, whatever the military say, and because the civilians have much more ambitious objectives than the military at this point. There will be demonstrations, which means more people in camps, improvised camps, bigger demonstrations, and bigger wars. I think we'll have, at that point, these several hundred thousand men in Iraq after a year or two, which Shinseki suggested they needed right at the beginning, and which they obviously need now to fulfill the president's purposes. I think nuclear testing will start then, if it hasn't already. I don't think it will have beforehand. So nuclear testing will start here, starting a wave of proliferation around the world.
This is a very scary scenario. Now that you've given us really an incredibly frightening scenario, some of which I know, as you said, we're in a rolling coup, what do you recommend people do about it?
Well, there are two websites right now, one run by Naomi Wolf called AmericanFreedomCampaign.org, which has regular action proposals and an agenda, and the other run by the conservative lawyer Bruce Fein, AmericanFreedomAgenda.org, both worth looking at very much. There's the impeachment process, which was just pushed by Kucinich. But above all, I think pressing our representatives that we demand, with the sanction that we will work against them to remove them from office if they do not begin to fulfill their oath of office, which is to support and defend the Constitution. Dianne Feinstein and Charles Schumer are two Democrats who violated that oath, which they took, like every other congressperson, by voting for Mukasey. And I would say the Republicans who voted also violated their oaths on that point. And they've been doing that a lot, as in the NSA surveillance. We should let them know that that is unacceptable. We demand that the old Constitution be upheld, not just because it's traditional, but because it protects us from tyranny. Something, by the way, the system has not been doing. It's failed to do that so far, and it further failures lie ahead unless we get more active. We don't have fascism here as we speak, or we wouldn't be speaking on this program. But we have something I could call latent fascism.
And I think it's a good description, latent fascism, and the threat that we may have real fascism.
Well, thank you, Michael Ratner, for all that you've been doing in the Center for Constitutional Rights and for this program. So.
Daniel, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, you were the model we were based on, Daniel.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Keep fighting.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
There's no terrorist. If there is any terrorist, he's living in the White House.
At a recent demonstration, Law and Disorder caught up with a number of protesters from the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the Society of American Law Teachers in front of the Pakistani mission. Walking through the event, co-host Michael Smith and I had the opportunity to catch up with a number of attorneys and activists. Let's have a listen.
Joel Kupferman, National Lawyers Guild, New York City chapter executive board member and head of the Environmental Justice Committee of the Guild. This idea came to me to call for this demonstration, which I've learned is now in 5 different cities that the Guild and SALT and Center for Constitutional Rights has orchestrated. I feel safe because not only are the lawyers that I work with on a daily basis with the Guild, but many of my law professors came from SALT, from TORO. The people that taught me to stick up for people's rights and to basically enforce the law and have the right to lawyers. I made a phone call and all these lawyers appeared. If I was in Pakistan and I made a call, there was no lawyers. 25% of the lawyers are gone. I'd have to go to prison to visit those lawyers, and probably the way things are going in Pakistan, I'd probably end up in that prison just for wanting to speak to a lawyer. In many, many cases, the federal government, the Bush regime, has sort of let known to lawyers that don't push too far in representing people who are protesting. Many, many demonstrations, it was Guild, Mass Defense, I'm wearing the green hat right now, those lawyers, us have been arrested at demonstrations. If we don't have the right to demonstrate, people have the right to have a lawyer to represent them when they're demonstrating, all is lost. And in some ways, the voice that you're hearing on this radio is going to be squelched, because we don't want someone determining who you're listening to and what you're listening to and who's holding the mic in front of me now. Fortunately, we still have some freedom here, but it's important that we protect it, not just here, but especially places like Pakistan, where all this U.S. money, your tax dollars, those who are paying taxes here, that all that money is going up to prop up this bad regime. And we're told that, hold on. But we know that when lawyers and judges not just are suppressed, but are arrested and thrown in jail, that the basis of democracy is totally at risk.
My name is Shahid Kamrade, and I'm a Secretary General of Pakistan USA Freedom Forum. This organization comes out after the 9/11, when the FBI, federal government, without any warrant, without any something, they break in the door of the Muslim Pakistanis in the name of terror, and they never find a single terrorist in the home of the Pakistani families. That was a breach to the Constitution of the United States. You cannot go to the middle of the night to the people's house and picking only the men in the name of terror, no. That's why this Pakistan USA Freedom Forum, and thank God we got a very big support from the American friends. This country will not be hands on the bush, and nobody will play with the Constitution.
Why are you here in front of the mission today?
This is a Pakistani consulate mission over here, and we are trying to tell the whole world that the Pakistani living abroad with the other friends, United States citizens, born citizens, and everybody over here, we are very, very much, I mean, disturbed and feeling shameful that the Bush government, how he nakedly, nakedly going against 165 million Pakistani people's wishes. And what's the wishes? That they need democracy. They need judiciary system, fair and fair election, clean and fair election. And this Bush government, who said that they are going for spread the democracy, but if this is the democracy when you're supporting the dictator of Musharraf in the name of so-called terrorist, Pakistan USA Freedom Forum, which is my secretary, we are again saying Pakistan USA Freedom Forum believe this is the war of terror, is a hoopla, is a shame, it's a people, yes, this war of terror is nothing to do with anything except to get the more money from the oils, put in a government, dictator government, if they suit them. We should have dictator's army. Bush cannot see this thing. And now what he did with the judges in my country, Pakistan, I'm very much proud, I'm telling the whole world, the day one of the civilization on this earth, Pakistan is the only country where the 12 Supreme Court justices stand up against the brutality, against the dictator. There's no country like Pakistan, 12 Supreme Court justices. I'm very much proud of my justices. I'm very much proud of the lawyers, and I'm very much proud of the students and labor and political things. But I'm going to tell it. If this struggle will going to change in the engineered or the pushing by the United States or George Bush cronies like a Benazir Bhutto, that's not answer. You will have the same problem. She is alleged corrupt in my country, Benazir Bhutto. She's a friend of the Bush. She is the second Musharraf. We want a free and fair election in Pakistan, and that's why we are here. And everybody listen now, Pakistani people, maybe we are poor, but we stand for the Constitution, same way like the United States, same way like in French, same way like in United Kingdom. Even the United Kingdom have no written Constitution. Thank God we have a written Constitution, and I'm very much proud of this. And thank God we got a very big support from the American friends. This country will not be hands on the Bush, and nobody will play with the Constitution.
Do you have a website?
Yeah. We have an email address. Email address is PAKUSA. It's a one word. It's PAKUSA and two time FFF at hotmail.com.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure for coming down over here, and thank you very much for your support.
We caught up with Jonathan Moore in front of the mission. Jonathan, why are you here today?
Well, I'm here to join in the collective voice in opposition to the imposition of martial law and the attacks on the legal system and the judiciary in Pakistan, because we believe that what happens in Pakistan affects what happens in this country and vice versa.
Why is it important for attorneys in particular to be out here today?
Well, it's critical for attorneys to be out here today. For one, the attack right now in Pakistan is on many levels, but on one level it's a critical attack on the judiciary and on the legal system. So that's very important. And we see the same kind of attacks that have gone on, not in that same kind of way, but in similar ways on the legal system here in the U.S. in the last few years. So with the suspension of habeas corpus, the detention of people without the right to an attorney, without being able to contact their families, essentially the imposition of draconian laws that challenge the people's right to protest and to demonstrate. It's important there, it's important here, so that's why we raise our voice.
That was New York City criminal defense attorney Jonathan Moore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
At a recent demonstration in front of the Pakistani mission in New York, Law and Disorder caught up with a number of protesters from the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the Society of American Law Teachers. And we've just met with Jeannie Meyer, Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. Jeannie, why are you here in front of the mission today?
I think it's important that all lawyers in the country stand up for the bench and bar in Pakistan that are trying to fight for a free an independent judiciary. I was thinking this morning about how what this would be like in the U.S. if Bush arrested all of the lawyers and all of the judges that he didn't appoint who were not friendly to him and put them in jail, and what kind of country this would be, and if they wanted to hold free elections under those circumstances. And I think that's what's facing the people of Pakistan, is that the elements of civil society that are speaking out against repression are being repressed themselves. And this is no way to fight terrorism. Also, Akhtar Hussein, who is the IADL Deputy Secretary General, was arrested after he chaired the Bar Association at the Sindh High Court, passed a resolution against the military courts and all of the actions since the emergency orders.
My name is Michael Heflin, and I'm the campaigns director for Amnesty International USA. And I'm here today with the Lawyers Guild and other organizations because I think it's really critical that we stand up and speak out against what's happening in Pakistan. I mean, it's really at a very critical juncture. Many of your listeners probably already know that, you know, not only hundreds but thousands now of individuals have been arrested in Pakistan. In particular, the independent judiciary, the government has gone after. Members of the Supreme Court are under house arrest, including the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, major human rights activists, including the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion, is under house arrest. You know, political opposition leaders are under house arrest. So it's really, really a, you know, very, very terrible situation. So, you know, I think it's particularly important that people in the U.S. speak out, because the U.S. government is the one government that has significant influence over what's happening in Pakistan. And so I think if we really mobilize in the United States, there's a chance that we can pressure our government to put even more pressure on Pakistan.
Is that what's happening now with Amnesty? Are they organizing?
We are, absolutely. And we're doing that on a global level. But as I was saying, I think those of us who are here in the United States, we have a special responsibility because of the particular relationship between the Pakistan government and the U.S. government. What we've been doing is a number of things to try to get the U.S. administration to speak out more forcefully. We actually delivered a letter to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, along with 12 other human rights organizations, asking for the U.S. to cease all military and security assistance to the Pakistan government immediately until you know, things are changed. So hopefully she'll read that letter. We've been assured that she will, but I think it's still going to take a tremendous amount of pressure. And one of the things that we're doing is having our members send emails and write to Condoleezza Rice, to other U.S. officials, and demand that they put more pressure on the Pakistan government. So I hope your listeners will also take those kinds of actions and contact the Secretary of State's office, contact your members of Congress and your U.S. senators, and ask them to get the U.S. government to apply the pressure that's needed.
Hazel, and since you were privy to the conversation with the Pakistani diplomat, I wonder whether we could interview you about what he had to say.
Surely. He justified the use of military law and emergency law on the basis not to stop rational people, but in order to stop the element of extremism. So his entire attitude was, you are a rational person. I am a rational person. We can have a conversation with each other. We can disagree with each other. However, there are elements in Pakistan right now who cannot engage in that kind of conversation. And in order to preserve the ability to have elections, they had to institute martial law, and they didn't want to do it.
And we're also here with Peter Weiss, who's the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Peter, what was your impression of the conversation you had with the Pakistani diplomat?
Well, he said, not surprisingly, that it was only the unscrupulous lawyers who got arrested. We know how dangerous unscrupulous lawyers are, right?
I think that with that formulation, we're all in danger.
But we also asked him how you could have meaningful elections while most of the opposition leaders are in jail. And he said, well, we had to jail them so that we could have free elections.
Well, Hazel, I should add, is the executive director of the Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, just took the position 2 months ago. What was your impression, Hazel?
Well, he was being very diplomatic. It was his job to come out and to speak with us, and he did, and he didn't really say anything, but I don't think there's anything more dramatic than seeing the photographs of crowds of attorneys in their black suits and white shirts and black ties, like what I'm wearing, you know, marching down the street, understanding that if you don't have lawyers and judges, you can't have the rule of law. It's impossible.
What do you make of the Bush administration's position in continuing to arm the Pakistani government?
I think we're afraid of those 70 nuclear bombs that they allegedly have, and we are terrified. At least we know whose hands they're in if Musharraf is in power. I think it has to do with those nuclear weapons more than anything else.
What do you think, Peter?
No, I don't think it's the nuclear weapons. I think is that they're very comfortable with dictators in Washington. You know, they look for stability around the world. And if you got rid of Musharraf, they're saying, you know, who knows what might happen.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have Professor Brian D. Palmer from Trent University in Canada. He's written a path-breaking book called James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left, 1890 to 1928. Mike Davis has called it a book written by a master historian. What's interesting for us, all members of the National Lawyers Guild, is that Cannon came out of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, was a founding member and leader of the American Communist Party and the first leader of the International Labor Defense, which became the National Lawyers Guild 10 years later. We want to talk about the principles and practices of the IWW and how they translate into defending political prisoners today. Brian Palmer, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be in such distinguished left-wing legal company.
Well, that's how we feel about you. I know Cannon was part of that early generation of American socialists. His father was a Debsian socialist. Cannon himself joined the Socialist Party in 1908, was very active with the IWW, and then came the Russian Revolution and things changed in America. Pick up the story from there, will you?
From the Russian Revolution or before?
Before Cannon and the IWW and then the Russian Revolution, and then they decided to organize the International Labor Defense. How did Cannon's thinking evolve, and what did he learn from the movement that he was in, and what can we learn today from what those people did, our forefathers and mothers?
I think the critical point about Cannon, and one of particular interest to your listeners, is that he was schooled in the revolutionary movement, actually not in kind of socialist doctrine and texts, and not in trade unions, which many radicals of that period came out of. Rather, his sort of formative moment was in fact around labor defense, the kind of the thing that galvanized him, other than a family background where his father was a left winger and had been a member of the Knights of Labor and was involved in the Debsian socialist movement, and his father had the various reading material around the house. But Cannon was really galvanized by the labor defense campaigns of the very early 20th century, and particularly the Moyer-Haywood-Pettibone defense campaign of 1907, where they were Western Federation of Mine Worker Leaders, who were basically framed up on charges of killing a former governor of Idaho. And Cannon sort of went door to door, knocked on doors, tried to galvanize support in the small kind of working class neighborhood that he grew up in outside of Kansas City, a place called Rosedale, Kansas. And it was in that period that he really saw, I think, the struggle for social justice being thwarted by, you know, large capitalist interests, by the significant power of the state, and by the capacity of the judicial process in the eyes of many working class people to, you know, function in ways that really threatened basic, you know, attitudes towards social justice and the rights of individuals. And it was in that, as a teenager, that he was really schooled. And from there, he gravitated into the Socialist Party of America. But, you know, by 1910, 1911, he was finding it somewhat inadequate, and he sort of yearned, I think, for a more explicit class struggle kind of approach. He joined the Industrial Workers of the World, which was then the sort of radical edge of the labor movement, although it was very different than trade unions in the sense that what it struggled to build was one big union of all workers. And it had, while very much an interest in the defense of workers in workplaces, it also had fundamental to its being defense of free speech. And Cannon spent as much time kind of soapboxing and riding the rails as a hobo agitator, defending free speech, as he was trying to also organize workers and defend workers against employers who really wanted no part of labor organization or social justice or freedom of speech, etc. So it's really in that kind of 1911 to 1914, 1915 period, just about the time of the outbreak of World War One, that Cannon kind of learns the ropes of being a working class agitator in the Wobblies. The outbreak of war, and then 3 years later, the success of the Russian Revolution, moved him out of the Wobblies, who were an organization of, you know, tremendous courage and integrity, but also an organization that didn't put much stock in political parties or in organizing against the state. They thought you could basically take over the means of production, and if you controlled the means of production or could, you would inevitably control society and governance of that society. Cannon's, I think, eyes were opened by the war and the tremendous power of the state, and particularly the capacity of the state to whip up a kind of xenophobia and attachment of workers to the sort of patriotism of the state. He was also attracted immensely to the importance of the Russian Revolution, which saw a working class party, the Bolsheviks, actually being in a position at a moment of crisis to create the possibilities for a new workers' government. So the combination of those developments moved him in the direction away from the Wobblies and their point of production syndicalist kind of orientation and into an attachment to communism in which a working class party was central to the creation of a better, more humane world.
So Brian Palmer, for those who just tuned in, Brian has written James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left, and we're speaking with him and about his book and about Cannon eventually organizing what was the forerunner of the National Lawyers Guild, our organization, called the International Labor Defense. And as I understand that Cannon was one of the founding members and really one of the leaders of the Communist Party back in 1921. Several years later, the International Labor Defense was formed. I know that the famous slogan from the IWW, the Wobblies, was an injury to one is an injury to all. And was that the kind of thing that the International Labor Defense was trying to practice when it was formed? And who was involved in forming it, and what did they do?
Yeah, the old Wobbly slogan, an injury to one is the concern of all, was I suppose, the animating principle of the original International Labor Defense Organization, which was really born out of Cannon's commitment to social justice and to labor defense. And it had its original gestation or idea, if you will, in conversations that Cannon and his partner, Rose Karsner, who was an active communist as well, and Big Bill Haywood, the former Wobbly who had sought refuge in the Soviet Union after fleeing the United States under charges of various kind of criminal syndicalist and other allegations in the immediate aftermath of World War I, was actually the founding chair of the Communist Party. It was then known as the Workers' Party. Cannon and his wife Kerstner were in Russia in 1925, and a major part of the Comintern, the Communist International, a major part of its international work was to develop various international aid programs, the Friends of Soviet Russia, various aid to political prisoners in the sort of immediate aftermath of the World War I period. There were some 85,000 political prisoners spread across Europe at that time. And there were also many in the United States. And so the Comintern's initiative in this, sort of stoked the fires of sort of American ingenuity in terms of Haywood, Cannon, and Kerstner discussing this. And they thought that they could Americanize this Comintern project by creating an organization in the United States called the International Labor Defense, an organization and a name that they thought would resonate with all the old radical traditions of labor defense that had sort of really been sort of building in the United States since the 1880s and the state murder of the Haymarket martyrs through the opening decades of the 20th century into the World War I period, when many workers were incarcerated, many radicals were deported, and into the 1920s.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that they tried to build an organization, they just didn't capture themselves. They had other radicals from various tendencies in the country. They had liberals. They had other organizations. They didn't try to go around other organizations, but through them. It reminded me of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, in the sense that they raised money for prisoners and their families and their children. They put out a newspaper, the Labor Defender, which had a huge circulation, bigger than the Communist Party paper. They had organizers in the main cities in America, like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles, San Francisco. And this was a substantial, what we would call now a mass defense organization, a United Front organization that Cannon headed. Tell us about what they did with the Sacco and Vanzetti defense, because to this day that defense still resonates in our country.
Well, I think the Sacco and Vanzetti defense mobilization, which of course had many other organizations involved other than the ILD, but what Cannon and the ILD saw this as it's really a touchstone of freedom in America. If America was going to be the land of the free, then the sort of railroading to jail of two Italian-American anarchists for their beliefs had to be fought and was a touchstone of all that sort of the labor defense tradition, the socialist and communist traditions, even the trade union tradition stood for in America. And what Cannon, of course, confronted in that situation was a very, in some senses, vibrant, united front, as you said, kind of popular mobilization, but also the tendency of elements within that mobilization to sort of typecast communists as sectarian, as interested only in their own cause, as always trying to sort of steer things into their own camp and capture the broad movement. And so Cannon and Kerstner worked very diligently to not fall into anything that could be conceived as doing those kinds of things. So they worked with a range of other groups where they also stood on principle all the time, both sort of had to struggle against anti-communism and to struggle for Sacco and Vanzetti. But they were able to bridge these kinds of gaps very effectively. As you said, they put out the mass newspaper, which they circulated hundreds of thousands of pamphlets, leaflets, of posters on Sacco and Vanzetti. They organized to try to beat back the execution of these two victims of state repression. They called on workers to mount general strikes on the eve of their execution, some of which were undertaken by workers at various locales. And all of this, too, it must be remembered, Cannon was in some sense doing against the grain. I mean, there were elements in the Communist Party that were interested more in taking over the Sacco-Vanzetti campaign, and he had to fight against them on some levels. He had to fight against those who would sort of tar any effort of communists to play a part in this campaign with an anti-communist brush. And in it all, I think what Cannon was and Kirstner and others in the ILT were exemplary advocates of a non-sectarian, as you said, united front, build a mass mobilization around basic premises and principles. And too often that's been lost in labor defense. I think this was, Cannon felt that this was really the purest and best of the communist milieu in the 1920s, the selfless struggle for justice, the selfless defense of those who had been victimized.
Brian Palmer, author of James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left, 1890 to 1928, it was around that time in the 20s that Clarence Darrow said, there is no justice inside the courts or outside. And how does the international labor defense notion of how to defend people jibe with that observation of Clarence Darrow?
Well, I think that what the international labor defense was all about was a very broad approach to defense. It probably had the skepticism of Darrow in the sense that Cannon and others did not think from bourgeois courts could be sort of wrung a great deal of justice. On the other hand, they knew that there were possibilities in democratic America that needed to be pushed and exploited, and that could, in fact, wring some concessions. So they were absolutely adamant that one followed through the legal defense of various workers who were brought before courts on various charges. So they paid for lawyers, they raised money for lawyers, they worked very closely with lawyers, and they worked very closely with the kinds of defense campaigns the particular individuals who were facing incarceration wanted. That said, they probably did deeply understand that there would be no justice in America, and so they tried to develop ways of creating mass mobilizations, demonstrations, protests, etc., that would actually stop the process of the courts being used against workers. So they would, for instance, campaign against alien workers who were threatened with deportation. Many of these going back to, for instance, in the 1920s, to fascist Italy, for instance, where they would likely face execution and death. They tried desperately and mounted campaigns and mobilizations to stop the vicious, vigilante, racist lynch law in the American South and elsewhere to defend blacks from, for instance, incredible oppressions that they faced in the 1920s. And when and if workers ended up in jail because of their radical or revolutionary activities, or because they were simply framed and railroaded, Cannon and the ILT made sure that their time in prison was spent with the notion that they had people behind them. They sent money to them on a regular basis. They went to visit them in jail. They ran interviews with them in their press, which went to tens and hundreds of thousands of people. They kept alive the memory of sort of working class martyrs from Haymarket in the 1880s on. And they also did something that had never before been really appreciated and done in the labor defense movement, is that they made an effort to look after the families of these incarcerated class war prisoners. They sent their children presents at Christmas. They sent their wives money for food and basic necessities every month throughout the year. So there was a sense that when justice in America was proven to be hollow, and there were those who were suffering as a consequence, that there would be people there who wouldn't abandon them and who would do what they could, as modest as that was, but nevertheless quite significant, to make sure that these people weren't forgotten, to make sure that their families were remembered, to make sure that it was in the sort of historical record that there would be people supporting people who went to jail for their beliefs and their ideas and their actions.
Brian Palmer, you've done a real service for the left here in the United States. I know it's taken you some 10 years to write James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left, 1890 to 1928. It's a book written, one of the reviews I read with panache, extremely well written and wonderful to read this really hidden history that those of us in the Lawyers Guild really don't know that much about. But we do now, thanks to you. On behalf of Heidi Boghossian and myself, we really appreciated your coming on the show. Brian Palmer, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. It's a great show to be on. It was my privilege.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.